It's the 19th of April, 2024, and this is the Room Now Podcast. Hi, I'm Dr. Jack Cush, Executive Editor of RoomNow.com. This week on the podcast, we're talking Sjogren's. We're talking some regulatory stuff. We're talking hope for MDA5, and we'll end up talking about the canary in the coal mine. At the top, let's go into mental health, something we don't talk much about, but really do need to pay attention to. This particular study of over 1,150 adolescents and young adults with JIA, 43% of whom had oligo, 26% had poly, the rest were like combinations or whatever. These were older kids with a mean age in the teens who had had disease for an average of 7+ years. And the sad thing in this survey study was that 30% of them had expressed incredibly negative thoughts, including suicidal ideation, that 19%, one in five, had moderate to severe symptoms of either depression or anxiety, and that these findings were almost 2.5-fold higher in young girls with JIA. It's something we need to ask about. You can imagine what these numbers might be if we did the same surveys in our adults. It probably would be about the same. Shockingly, one in five or more that we would recognize having serious mental health concerns that need to be addressed, but no one's addressing them. Why does that not happen? I think it's because everyone thinks you're the smartest doctor that they know, and they don't go to a primary care doctor. They don't like to go to see other specialists, even when you refer them. They think you understand them. So it's with your guidance that these things get, number one, recognized, and number two, dealt with. We do have a few studies about Sjogren's this week. This one study compared the yield of minor labial salivary gland biopsies versus parotid gland biopsies. This is a study from the Netherlands that prospectively obtained both labial and parotid biopsies in a large cohort of patients who had Sicca complaints. I think only about a third of them were confirmed to have Sjogren's syndrome, and the rest of them were just Sicca symptoms without Sjogren's. But the take-home on this is while both of those biopsy sites were valid and useful in the diagnosis and classification of Sjogren's disease, that there was a skew in what you would find. You're more likely to find inflammatory findings in the minor labial gland biopsies. And you're more likely to find B-cell abnormalities, B-cell hyperactivity in the parotids, both of those being firmly reasonable features of Sjogren's disease. I must say I don't do, I don't think I've ever done parotid biopsies. There's a risk in doing them. You have to be really expert in doing that. Minor salivary I've done from time to time, often in problematic cases, and we'll get into the British Society of Rheumatology's recommendations on whether or not you should do salivary gland biopsies and under what circumstances. I think what they said was if you have a high index of suspicion despite clinical or laboratory findings, you might want to do that. Okay. Another authority this week, the FDA approved a new biosimilar, this one for the IL-12/23 inhibitor ustekinumab. The drug Stelara now has competition. It's ustekinumab, AEKN, if you live in the United States, and if you don't live in the United States, you're laughing at us. The worldwide name of this drug is Selardsi, S-E-L-A-R-D-S-I, coming from Teva and Alvotech. It's now approved, this biosimilar of Selardsi, of ustekinumab, for use in plaque psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, both in adults and in kids. AbbVie this week announced preliminary positive results from a phase 3 trial called the SELECT GCA trial. Yes, JAK inhibitors being used in giant cell arteritis. In that study, they showed that their drug, the upadacitinib, was capable of giving significant remission rates, 46%, compared to 29% in the placebo population in a 52-week study. This was a trial where There was, I think, an aggressive steroid withdrawal over the first 26 weeks, and they looked at remission as an outcome measure. And those results, again, it's preliminary, don't have all the data. We assume it's going to be presented at an upcoming meeting, hopefully in the near future. This adds to the widening arsenal of drugs that will be approved for use in GCA. Right now, we only have the IL-6 inhibitor tocilizumab. There are other studies underway with the other IL-6 inhibitor sarilumab, the IL-17 inhibitor secukinumab, and JAK now inhibitors are in the game, and maybe in a year or two, it'll be a crowded horizon. The question is, when you have more expensive options and more marketing and more education on GCA, will you be more likely to use them? Right now, we still are very steroid dependent, very steroid focused. It's easy to write them, it's harder to stop them. PNAS, a great scientific journal, has a nice article about the pathogenesis of MDA5 induced lung disease, where they get a rapidly progressive, not all, as we discussed last week, not all, but many get a rapidly progressive ILD form that has a very high mortality rate. Identifying these people early, getting early treatment is important. In this mice model, where they induced fibrotic ILD using MDA5 as an antigen, they showed that, one, they could induce something that looked just like what we see in humans, but that, again, in their animal model, that treatment with either targeting CD4 with a CD4 depleting monoclonal antibody or inhibiting IL-6 with an IL-6 receptor antibody, that ameliorated the progression to MDA5-associated ILD. Maybe that's a clue for where we should be going in the future. IL-6, we know, is very much involved in the amplification of interstitial lung disease, and that's not just in dermatomyositis, but also in RA and other conditions. CD4, it's a proximal step and makes some sort of sense. Will these translate to humans? It's not. Again, we are treating humans and not mice. We need to wait and see. The argument comes up sometimes about what drugs are most effective in patients who have spondyloarthropathy conditions and who develop anterior uveitis. We certainly have always said it's the monoclonal antibodies against TNF that are protective. In this meta-analysis of 44 randomized controlled trials, they showed that the placebo rate was 11, shall we say, it's an incident rate, but that the monoclonal antibodies against TNF was 4.1, a 60% reduction. Even etanercept, 5.4, what looks like about a 45% reduction. IL-17, almost a 70% reduction, and JAK inhibitors, almost an 85% induction. The point being, on those therapies, TNFs, IL-17s, JAK inhibitors, you are probably preventing new uveitis events. Now, whether that translates to the using these drugs to treat new uveitis is another story, and this meta-analysis was not designed to answer that question. I like this research report on what happens to people after pegloticase. Often the question is with pegloticase, actually the biggest question is who should get on it. That shouldn't be hard. Your disastrous patients, the patients who need it most, the patients who are at the highest risk, we tend not to use, I think, enough pegloticase. But I know it's hard from personal experience to get people on pegloticase because they are so sick. They do have so many comorbidities. They just got out of the hospital with an MI and heart failure, and they have renal failure, and they're a mess. And you want to give them another expensive intervention, I think it's something to consider. So in this study of 375 patients who discontinued pegloticase, what happened to them? So they took on average or median of 8 infusions. They were treated for up to 1,200 days. That's 4 years almost. And 73% did have a uric acid below 6 during pegloticase. I'm wondering what the heck. So 73% less than 6. Everybody I've given pegloticase to, it went to undetectable, right? 100%. Of course, my N is very small. So this means not everybody is successful. And that may include people who fail from other reasons. Anyway, after discontinuation, 84% of people went on a urate-lowering drug. Most of that was allopurinol. A third of that was febuxostat. After 30 days of being off pegloticase, about half were still within target with a serum uric acid of less than 6. So that's encouraging, but it also tells you that you need an aftercare plan when stopping pegloticase. You're going to need to move on to something else. An article that comes out, I think, just recently in JAMA Internal Medicine about SGLT2 inhibitors and what it may do to gout. As you know, SGLT2 inhibitors are novel therapies that have revolutionized type 2 diabetes. They're being used in other indications as well with other comorbidity benefits. They've been associated with lowering of uric acid levels. SGLT2 inhibitors include drugs like Invokana, Jardiance, and Farxiga. So in this particular study from Canada, almost 35,000 propensity-matched patients with type 2 diabetes, they either went on a sulfonylurea like glyburide or an SGLT2 inhibitor, and the outcome here was incident gout or MACE or gout flares. There was a significantly lower rate with the SGLT2. It looked like it was about a 38% reduction with a hazard ratio of 6.2. The SGLT2 inhibitor rate was 4.27 events, and the sulfonylurea, it was almost 6.9 events per 1,000 patient years. Patients on the SGLT2 inhibitors also had a 33% lower rate of gout flares if they had gout. They had a significantly lower rate of MACE events that was 13% lower, and a significantly 47% reduction in heart failure. So again, we're seeing a lot of data in our patients about the use of SGLT2 inhibitors and also the GLP-1 agonists in our patients who have diabetes, with diabetes being the primary indication, but it's benefiting certainly gout. It's benefiting RA. It's benefiting, you know, a number of different conditions. And I think that's very encouraging. We're going to see more research about this. An article appeared this week that was notable, but also I think a little controversial. And it's about the higher risk of death and serious infections in RAILD patients. A study of 148 patients. This is a multi-center, multinational trial of 148 patients followed for almost 16 months. And they looked at serious infection rates. And that means hospitalizable, IV antibiotics, changes, morbidity, mortality, that sort of thing. Standard definition. But the rate of serious infections in this population was really high. It's 52 per 100 patient years. What? I'll remind you, the RA serious infection rate done by, was it Dorner from the Mayo Clinic? In the pre-biologic era, it was 3 to 9 SIEs per 100 patient years. We're talking about pneumonias, meningitis, septic arthritis, that sort of thing. 3 to 9. In these RAILD patients, obviously sicker, 52 per 100. So half of them are going to get serious infections. And in this group, 32% of them died. 48 out of the 148 died, with two-thirds of them dying from serious infection. The serious infections were mostly respiratory infections. The most common bugs were COVID, strep pneumoniae, pseudomonas, and influenza A. So common bugs, but these people are really at risk. This is the canary in the coal mine. If your RA patient has ILD, evidenced by shortness of breath, changing chest x-ray, you know, low pulse ox in the finger, you know, work them up, evaluate them, get them to a lung specialist or an RA lung specialist, and get aggressive. You know, I've had a pulmonologist, I remember this vividly, 20 years ago, telling one of my favorite patients who was having some shortness of breath, sent him to the lung doctor. He diagnosed him with RAILD. This very nice man, pulmonologist, great doc. First thing he said to my patient was, get your affairs in order. You're going to be dead in 5 years. I thought, oh my God, that's like callous, harsh, slap in the face. the patient came back to me, a successful businessman, very nice man. He was almost in tears by this. You know, he expected to live many, many years. And I said, yeah, I think that was overstated. I don't think you're going to be dead in 5 years. I don't have much indication of that. Now, the pulmonologist knew the data. I knew it less well at the time. Who was right? Well, we were both kind of right, meaning that the patient died sooner than I expected. And he died 8 years later. And he died of a cancer death, and he had some heart problems. So it was, but, you know, just because you have RAILD doesn't mean you're going to die a pulmonary death. It means you're going to get a lot of other comorbidities, including infection. So this is the canary in the coal mine. This is something you need to pay attention to. I want to end with the British Society of Rheumatology came up with guidelines on the management of adults and pediatric cases of Sjogren's disease. You can look at the citation on the website. You can read our article. We provide a synopsis of the recommendations that they had. So these are all experts. They go through the grade technology. They score their data, and they did this with PICO questions. So they had a total of 19 questions that face the rheumatologist and patient dealing with Sjogren's disease, and they gave you the evidence-based recommendations. I got to tell you, a lot of these recommendations are expert-based, meaning they're not based on a well-done trial. These are expert opinion, and two, with low evidence, low-grade evidence. But these are, you know, the European and British leaders in the area, and I would take their advice before I would take my advice. Here's some of the things that they said that I think are worth noting. And I agree with all of these, and when I don't, I'll tell you. They say that ANA should be done when there's a clinical suspicion of connective tissue disease or Sjogren's disease. And that's, you don't go fishing, obviously, for Sjogren's without evidence to do the test. They say it's worth doing an ENA, testing for Rho and La, even if the ANA is negative, but you still have a high index of suspicion based on clinical grounds. When asked about whether there's a role for ultrasound, they said, really, at this point, there isn't enough of a role because not enough data, not enough expertise, but there is some evidence of its utility, but they don't recommend ultrasound or imaging in general for Sjogren's syndromes, unless you're considering another condition like a lymphoma complicating Sjogren's. They suggest that you consider a minor labial gland biopsy to aid the diagnosis when you clinically suspect Sjogren's syndrome and where the diagnosis cannot be made by clinical or serologic features alone. That's helpful. It's kind of what we said earlier in this report. There are no biomarkers for Sjogren's syndrome, but yet they do recommend labs. And I think the labs are not so much about Sjogren's, but often about the differential diagnosis or the comorbidities associated with Sjogren's. So they do recommend vitamin D. Oh, God help me. Don't get me started. I don't know what vitamin D is going to do for you when you're considering Sjogren's syndrome. It certainly isn't going to cure Sjogren's syndrome. That's my editorial opinion. The rest of these I'll go along with. Thyroid function tests, liver functions tests, TTG, immunoglobulin levels, SPEPs, serum bicarb, and creatinine kinase assessments. And the last question that I'll review, and again, I'll give you some of these recommendations in the report. Go to the actual article, download it. It's got a lot of good evidence, and it's a long read, but it's got a lot of good evidence. When asked what therapies should you employ, advanced therapies for the treatment, you know, for eye symptoms, all the eye drop stuff that you would recommend, and including autologous eye drops and even cyclosporine eye drops there, and saliva replacements and the drugs that you use for that, Evoxac and Saligen and whatnot. What about systemic things? They recommend for patients with fatigue and systemic symptoms, consider a trial of hydroxychloroquine. Hello? It doesn't affect eye symptoms or mouth symptoms. It does make people feel better. It lowers pain levels. All that probably due to secondary fibromyalgia. But don't think for a second you're really treating the cause of Sjogren's syndrome, is my opinion on that. By the way, that's 2C. That's expert opinion, low-grade evidence. Systemic steroids can have a short-term use, but should not be used routinely in the management of Sjogren's disease. Conventional immunosuppressives are not routinely recommended outside of using it for the treatment of specific systemic complications like arthritis, right? And I mean swollen synovitis arthritis, right? And lastly, biologic drugs are not currently recommended for use in Sjogren's disease outside the treatment of specific systemic complications. Again, 2C, expert opinion, low-grade evidence. I bring this up because at this current time, I know of four companies that are developing biologics that they think are going to be marketed for Sjogren's disease. Yet there's probably six or seven biologics that have failed in Sjogren's studies. But these other four companies are going ahead. Why are they going ahead with this? Well, Sjogren's syndrome, you know, one time I was a fellow, and one of my jobs as a fellow was to pick up the visiting professor. So we had the great Norman Talal visiting UT Southwestern to do grand rounds. And I got to pick him up at the airport and drive him around, and I'm a 27-year-old fellow, and the great Norman Talal, world-famous rheumatologist from UT San Antonio, world-famous for his work and teaching and research in Sjogren's. I know this. Everybody knows this. That's why he's coming to Southwestern. He asked me the question after he tells me to turn down the radio. Like he's thinking I'm a punk, listening to punk rock. He tells me, turn down the radio. What do you think is the most common autoimmune disease? And I said, rheumatoid. Of course, I got Norm Talal sitting next to me. His elbow is touching my... He said he's a big man. His elbow's touching my shoulder. And he looks at me with disdain and says, hello, Sjogren's syndrome. And I said, well, not... And he goes, primary and secondary, easily the most common autoimmune disease worldwide. You're right, sir. And thank God there was only about 10 minutes left in the drive, so I got about 10 minutes of disdainful preaching. But I learned a lot about Sjogren's during that talk. And it is a tremendous market, and there's a tremendous unmet need. But proving that a biologic is going to work in Sjogren's, all I can say is good luck with that. That's it for this week on the podcast. Make sure you tune in. Wait a second. I think I have a Ask Kush Anything recording. If I can pull this up in world speed time. Oh my goodness, I'm not finding it. SpeakPipe, here we go. Let's listen to this particular SpeakPipe. I'm doing this cold. This is from Karen Kermayer. Let's listen to what she has to say. And again, I'm doing this cold. Didn't listen to it, but you're going to hear it for the first time. We'll see just how good Kush is.
My name is Karen Kermayer. I'm a rheumatologist practicing in Argentina. This is a 65-year-old man with a history of seropositive RA, pulmonary fibrosis, and metabolic dysfunction, steatotic liver disease. His RA is well controlled with 15 milligrams per week of methotrexate. No corticosteroids are needed. He has a whip pattern on chest CT, restrictive pulmonary function test in the moderate range. His diffusion capacity is moderately low in 61%. He also has an estimated mean pulmonary artery pressure on echo of 25 with signs of right heart overload. His liver fibrosis is estimated in F1, F2 on MRI with normal LFTs. My questions to Dr. Kush are, would you change DMARD treatment considering targeting lung disease despite no articular inflammation? And would you stop methotrexate for toxicity in this case?
Thank you, Karen. That's a common scenario and a great question. And I'm delighted to say I have an answer of which I'll be proud and can live by. I was kind of worried you're going to ask me about TTG testing and, you know, and myositis or something. So Karen's question has to do with an RA patient, RA well-controlled, but RA is complicated by NASH and by ILD, but that the only therapy that's on board is methotrexate. So if you're a pulmonologist, you'd be like pulling your hair out of your head, screaming those crazy, idiotic rheumatologists using methotrexate and someone with ILD. Well, how dare they? Well, again, they're wrong. They have no evidence that you cannot use methotrexate in ILD patients. Methotrexate causes acute hypersensitivity pneumonitis. RAILD is a totally different biology. Now, if someone had an end-stage lung and you didn't want to risk it, I understand that. But yes, use methotrexate, but this patient needs more. And we don't have therapies that are going to affect the outcome. More effective treatment. If this patient had activity, inflammatory activity, and you're going to better control by adding a TNF inhibitor, an IL-6 inhibitor, you know, abatacept, whatever, tuximab, you know, would the patient do better ILD-wise? Generally not. There's anecdotalism about the use of rituximab in patients with extra-articular manifestations of RA like ILD, and that it may help, but honestly, I don't think there's any good evidence to support that. And until the approval of nintedanib, there was really no therapy other than that I would have entertained. So I think, yes, you could be more aggressive. No, I would not stop the methotrexate. I'd follow the LFTs, and I would watch the lung function. But I would consider adding nintedanib and co-managing that patient with a pulmonologist. The data on nintedanib, while it's hard to take and while it's expensive, shows that it at least stabilizes pulmonary outcomes in RA and autoimmune patients. Would you get the same if you use an IL-6 inhibitor or abatacept? And there's anecdotes in the literature about those two drugs as well. But my first choice would be to go with an approved therapy and hope that that's going to change that person's ultimate outcome. Make sure you tune in next week to Tuesday Night Rheumatology. We have our next program is going to feature a replay of our great session on spondyloarthritis. This session is sponsored by UCB. It features Leanne Gensler, Eric Ruderman, and Leahy Eder. We'll see you next week, Tuesday Night Rheumatology.